Good morning. My name's Shirley Templin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Shirley.
I guess you met my driver yesterday. He drove me to drinking. He drove me to treatment. And he drove me to Cartersville this weekend. My husband, stand up, Bo. He's my best friend, too. And there was a time when we were not best of friends. But today I can say that he's my driver, my lover, my best friend, my companion, my counselor, you name it, all rolled up in one. That's not a bad deal, is it? Now, I don't recommend that if you're not married to your best friend, go get another one. Just work on the one you got. I mean, I got a lot invested in this booger here. My sobriety date is July the 29th, 1982. And I'm proud of that. The big book says I share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. First of all, I would like to thank the committee for the gift. I have a feeling it's going to end up at my daughter's apartment. She takes everything that I have. You know, she's a mother that would look so great right there in that room. So I'm going to take it home with me. Hopefully it will stay. But if it doesn't, I want you to understand it'll be in good hands. I'm the oldest of three children. I have a brother, David, who's 4 years younger than I am. And last Thursday, I celebrated number 52 on my birthday, and I'm proud of that. I am so grateful to be a 52. Bo said he might trade me in for 226s, but I told him he wasn't wired for 226s. But I have this brother named David who's 4 years younger than I am, and he's normal. And I don't know what that means, except he's gone to the same job every year. He's lived in the same house. He has the same wife. He doesn't cuss. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. I don't know what the Sam Hill he does for fun. I have no idea. And then there's Gail, who's 8 years younger than I am, and she's somewhere in Tennessee working on her story. Boy, it ought to be a stem winder, I'm telling you. She's something. But when I graduated from elementary school, my parents signed the divorce papers the day I graduated from elementary school, and I don't know why that, but we thought we got the problem out of the house. My dad, I can't say that he's an alcoholic, but his drinking sure messed up a lot of us in this house, and my mom came to me and she said, pack up all your clothes. We're moving in with your grandparents. Tickle me to death. I just knew I'd be okay. I loved my grandmother and granddaddy. I was the oldest grandchild and I was spoiled rotten. And I will tell you from the podium that my grandchildren will all be spoiled. Every one of them. But we moved in with these grandparents in the summer that year. In September, I started to high school. I turned 14 that summer, and everything was going to be okay. I was going to be okay. My granny was going to teach me how to be a little lady. And my grandmother made all my clothes. And I can remember my grandmother every night would make me something different to wear to school the next day. She would sit by the fire at night if it was the cold weather and hem me a dress or hem a skirt or put a blouse together. Just so I would have something new to wear to school the next day. And I never was grateful for that. I always wanted something bought, but I always had it homemade. And what I wouldn't give right now for something homemade, you know? And I didn't appreciate that until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, this first Christmas at my grandparents' home was the best Christmas I'd ever had in my life. My mother did not sit around all day and cry like she always did. There were presents to open all day long. I can remember looking at my brother and saying, man, we have never gotten this many presents, you know. And it was just continuously all day long. And my dad was not around, and then my mom was not crying. And I thought, boy, if this is the way it's supposed to be, I love it. In January, my granny suddenly became ill, in the middle of January, and they took her to the hospital, and she never came home. She died at the age of 50 of cancer, and I didn't understand that. Man, I knew why my daddy was no longer around, but somebody please tell me why I had to lose my granny. You see, my mom never had the time to take time with me. There was always something going on, but my granny always took time for me. Well, my granddaddy came to my mom one night and sat her down at the kitchen table, and he said, "Louise, if you're going to live in my home, honey, you need to get a job with these three children." And see, my grandmother took care of everything, and as long as she was alive, my mom didn't have to work. And it was just really a lot of fun. And when my granddaddy said this to my mom, the first thing she said was, "If I've got to get a job, Dad, we'll move out." We did. We found us a little two-bedroom apartment on the other side of town and got as far away from him as she wanted to, and she found her a job. She had never had to work, and so she found a job working the night shift, 3 to 11. And what that meant was when she came in from work at night, we were all three in bed asleep. When we got up to go to school the next morning, she was in bed asleep. So my mom and I sort of switched roles, and that was okay. I knew that she needed me to do this for her, and of course we had weekends together, but I just assumed the role of taking care of Dave and Gail and making sure they had blue jeans for school the next day and that they got their homework the night before and that we all got to bed. And dating was not ever an issue. You know, I know we girls sat at the lunch table and we talked about that good-looking hunk on the table next door. Yes, there was such a word as hunk back then. And and paved roads, as my daughter would want to say, "Mom, did they have paved roads back then when you were dating Dad?" And I said, "Yes, they did." But dating was just not ever an issue. A girlfriend came to me one afternoon and she said, "I'm going out on a double date, a blind date. And do you think your mom would let you go?" And I thought, well, I'll ask her. So the date was for a Saturday night. My mom would be home from work. And when I asked her, she said, "Well, Shirley, I don't know. Blind dates, just nothing ever happens on a blind date." "Well, you heard him yesterday morning at 10 o'clock. You tell me things don't happen on a blind date." And this was before the drink. I can remember when I left for that date that night, my mom said, "Now, Shirley, don't you kiss him goodnight when he walks you to the door." And I thought, why not? And she said, "Good girls don't do that." My curfew was 10 o'clock, and our date started about 8. No wonder no one ever got in trouble. Back then, you never had time. And so I can remember we went skating that night, and when Bo walked me to the door, he tried to kiss me. And I remembered what my mom said. And she hadn't steered me wrong yet, so when Bo tried to kiss me, I wouldn't let him kiss me. And walked in the house, and there she was ironing. And she said, "Well, did he try to kiss you goodnight?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, but I didn't let him. You told me not to." And she said, "Well, he probably won't call you back anyway." And I said, "Well, why couldn't he kiss me if he's not going to call me back anyway?" And so I went to bed that night thinking, well, I blew it on my first blind date. But there was something that happened that night. I don't know what it was, but I fell in love with him instantly. I really did. I don't know whether it was his pretty blue eyes, his smile, or his personality. I don't know. I just don't know, but I fell in love with him. And I have been in love with him ever since. This past April the 30th, we celebrated anniversary number 32. And there's never in my life been anybody for me but Bo. I've never loved anybody but Bo. Now, there are a lot of those years I don't remember, but he does. Every single one of them. But anyway, so I went to bed that night, and I know I said a prayer like, "God, would you let him call me back? I'll let him kiss me this time." So after church on Sunday, the phone rang, and it was Bo, and he said, "Would you like to go out tonight?" I said, "I'd love to." So my curfew was 9 o'clock on Sunday night. Man, it's just a wonder we ever got together, you know. So he picked me up and he opened the car door and I slid across the front seat in the middle and he went around and got in his on his side of the car and he closed the door and he put his arm around me and he kissed me. And honey, he's been kissing me ever since. What is that in AA? Attraction rather than promotion. But well, anyway, we dated for 5 years and here we were, two young people madly in love, ready to tackle the world and do a lot of things. We enjoyed the 5 years we dated, but we talked an awful lot about getting married. And I was from this divorced family, and by this time he was. And we just didn't know about getting married and bringing children into this world. And so we made a commitment that if we got married, we were going to stay together come heck or high waters. That was it, that we were going to stay together. And bless his heart, he just didn't know the heck and high waters that he was going to have to go through with his little alcoholic. And let me explain to you about this love. Now, we fell in love, and we dated for 5 years, and then we had the two children, and this disease of alcoholism came roaring through this home. It was like a brick going through a big picture window. It just shattered it to pieces. And the best way that I can describe it is our love was like a gas stove. It had that tiny little pilot light, that tiny little flicker that never went out. Now, there were a number of years when the eyes were not on, a number of years. And this disease of alcoholism came through and just tore us all apart, sending us in four different directions. And when we came to these programs with Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Alateen, we were able to put that relationship back together. And I would like to tell you this morning that we have recovery going on in our home today. And I thank you for that. And all four of those eyes are wide open. And I thank you for that because it was not that way when we got here. Well, we set the date to get married, and when he put the ring on my finger, the first thing I thought of was, I got to call my daddy. I don't know why. I had looked at brides magazines and wedding pictures and albums and all these things, and it showed the bride walking down the aisle, this long white dress on the arm of her dad, and I thought, I got to call my dad. So I took down the Birmingham directory and looked it up, and there it was. Dialed my dad's number one afternoon, and when he answered the phone, he had that slur. He had that slur that I remembered so well. And I said, Dad, this is Shirley. And he said, oh, hey. And I wondered if he really remembered who I was. And I said, I'm getting married on April the 30th, Dad. Will you come and give me away? And he said, why, sure I will. You tell me what time and where the church is and what do I wear. And you can book it. I'll be there. And I believed him. One more time, I believed him. So we get to the church, and it's April the 30th. It's about 7:15, and this wedding's supposed to start at 7:30, and there's no daddy. And I'm getting a little nervous. I'm standing at the back of the church with my mom and my brother, and all the candles have been lit, and the music's playing quietly, and all the people are seated down front, and it's time. It's time for Bo to walk out from the down front of the church with the preacher and the best man. And it's time for this old girl to get down the aisle. And there's no daddy. And I'm thinking about all the times that he promised me that he'd come straight home from work and take us somewhere out to eat. Or he would take us to the fair. Or he would take us somewhere. Or if he would just come home. And he never made it. He never made it. And I'm thinking, what in this world am I going to do if he doesn't show up? And about that time, a couple of guys walked outside to smoke a cigarette, and I heard one of them say, hey, man, he just pulled right up on the sidewalk, didn't he? And I said, he's here. Didn't care where he pulled up, long as he pulled up. And I looked at my mom, and she looked at me, and about that time, here he comes through those big double doors to the back of that church, and he had that natural glow about him one more time. He had those red eyes instead of those pretty brown eyes. My daddy walked right over to me. My daddy looked at me, and my daddy looked at my mom, and he turned around and he walked out. And I said, I'm not believing this. Went out, got in the car on the sidewalk, pulled it off, and left. And I said, what am I going to do? My mom was just about to die. She just knew it was going to happen. She just didn't say anything. And my brother walked over, and he said, oh, come on and pull the veil down over your face. I'll walk you down the aisle. I've been trying to get rid of you for years. David walked me down the aisle. I guess that's really why today he claims he's responsible for us being married 32 years, and hey, we let him. I mean, it's a lot easier than having a fight. But my daddy left me at the back of that church because he was drunk. And I said, we'll never have alcohol in our home. We'll never have it in our home. Well, we left the church that night, and I was crying, and I know everyone was probably thinking I was crying because I was so happy, but once more, my daddy had rather have a drink than have anything to do with me. What was wrong with me? Why wouldn't my daddy have anything to do with me? Well, we left, and we went on our honeymoon, and we started on this journey called the Great American Dream. We were just two young kids madly in love. We knew we had that down pat. We knew we had that. We each had good jobs. First thing we wanted to do was build up enough down payment for that first little home. That's what we did. We moved in this first little home before our first wedding anniversary. And it had the great big fenced-in backyard for kids to play. And it had the two driveways. And it had the three bedrooms, one bedroom for a little girl and one bedroom for a little boy. And we were off and running. Second wedding anniversary, no kids, but we were trying. Third wedding anniversary, Bo pulled in the driveway in this little two-door red Thunderbird, and I thought I would die. It was gorgeous. I thought, is that for me? He said, yeah, that's yours. And on the way home from work one afternoon, a man pulled over in my lane and scraped me all the way down one side and just tore me apart. Didn't hurt anything. It just, I guess it was the fact that I had to call the police. Got home from work and called Bo and I told him to come out and look at my car. And he said, oh, no big deal, but I would like for you to go to the doctor and get him to check you over. And I said, but I'm fine. I didn't get hurt. And he said, well, I know, but you don't want to have a whiplash a couple of months down the road. You don't want something to happen to your back. Just for me, go to the doctor, have him check you over, and then you'll be okay. So the next morning, I called in work and told him I would not be in, and I went to the doctor, the good old family doctor in the family. And this doctor checked me over from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, When he got through, he said, Shirley, when you get dressed, go in my office and have a seat. I'll be right in to talk to you. And I thought, why does he want to talk to me? There's not anything wrong with me. I feel better than I have in months. But I went on in his office and I sat down. And a few minutes later, he came in. And instead of going over and sitting in front of his desk facing me, he pulled up a chair right beside me, and he tapped me on the knee, and he said, Shirley, you're 2 months pregnant. And I said, from the wreck? And the first thing out of my mouth was, I can't tell Bo. And he said, get him on the phone. So I called Bo up at work, and I handed the phone to him, and this doctor said, Bo, I've got Shirley in here, and I've checked her out, and she's 2 months pregnant. And you could hear Bo, from the wreck? Well, that little wreck's name was Mike. He was born November the 10th that year, the sunshine of my life, a little blonde-headed, blue-eyed hunk. And I ain't ever met anybody named Mike that wasn't a hunk. And I'm sorry, they just didn't put that name on anybody but hunks. And then I had another... Then I had another wreck, and her name is Sissy. She was born 17 months the very day after Mike, and she's brown-headed and brown-eyed, and I won't tell you about Sissy. Sissy's 27 years old today. Sissy's the little girl that was 13 and a half years old when I got sober, who wanted to commit suicide that summer. because she couldn't stand the pain. This is the little girl that stepped over me and covered me up and tucked me in bed at night. Never left the house because she was afraid of what would happen to Mom. This is the little girl who was a junior in high school that told me, "When I get out of high school, color me gone. I don't want anything else to do with you. I want out of your life." When she graduated from high school, she came to us and she said, I want to go to college, Mom. And I said, "What do you want to do?" And she said, "I want to work with alcoholics and their families." And she said, "I've told all my counselors there that I have all of the on-the-job training. I just need the book knowledge." And Cece's the little one who went to Alateen when she was 13 and a half years old. And when she was 20, they told her she couldn't come back to Alateen anymore because she needed to go into Al-Anon. And she went right over into the next room. The Al-Anons came to her one night and said, "Cece, will you sponsor the Alateen group?" And Cece said, "It'd be an honor, truly honor." That little girl is the sponsor of the Alateen group, Bessemer, that she grew up in. And I thank you for that, because Alateen raised my little girl. She went on, she went to college for 4 years, and she graduated. She got her degree, and now she works helping alcoholics and their families, and she loves it. She would come to me a couple of times and say, "Mom, do you think there's ever going to be a man for me?" And I'd say, "Sure there is. God's just not through with him. God's still working on him." She fell in love with this fellow, and we had told her, we had sat her down one night and told her, "We believe you're going to have to find somebody in the program, Cece, because no one else is going to understand you. As much as you're involved in this program and the Alateen sponsor, you're going to have to find somebody that's in this program that understands." And we were hoping for an Al-Anon. Well, we put in our order, and bless God's heart, he sent us Bob, a recovering alcoholic, 5 years of sobriety. And my little girl fell in love with Bob instantly, like I fell in love with her daddy. And she came to us and she said, "I want to get married in the church where you two married." And I thought about my daddy leaving me at the back of the church, and I thought, she won't ever have to worry about that. She won't ever have to worry about that. She got married this past February. In fact, it was 6 months yesterday. And we've come a long way. This was the little girl who wanted to commit suicide. And now her daddy's walking her down the aisle while her mother's on the front row sober. We lit a candle in memory of Mike. I didn't know if I could do that. I honestly didn't know if I could do that. But Cece came to me and she said, "Mom, this is my wedding, and my brother will always be a part of my life. You have to light that candle in memory of Mike." We opened the wedding with the Serenity Prayer, and we closed it with the Lord's Prayer. The man who married them was my counselor in treatment, who happens to be an ordained minister. You tell me that marriage ain't got a chance. Bob came along with two little kids, added attraction, added package deal. We have little Will, who's 5 years old, and Kale, who's 8. And as Cece walked down the aisle, a single lady, she came back up as not a stepmom. I don't think Cece will ever be a stepmom to these kids. She came back up as a mom, a wife, and Bo and I became instant grandparents. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for that. Thank you for that, for giving us that. Cece's 27 years old with 14 years in this program. If you don't know Cece, I hope one of these days your paths will cross, because she's truly a blessing, and she's mine. I qualified her for this program. Well, we had the two kids. We had a boy and girl. That's all the variety they had. Hey, we didn't have any more. And we didn't have any more bedrooms. We just wanted the 3 bedrooms. So we continued on with this great American dream, and it takes 2 paychecks. When Cece was 6 months old, I found this babysitter. I don't guess you would call her a babysitter. She was a godsend. Mama Betty would keep these children on weekends. She would keep them at night. Anytime we wanted to do something, Mama Betty was available. She taught my children a lot of things that I still see today in Cece. A lot of qualities, a lot of values that Mama Betty taught Cece. I went back to work, and it was at lunch one day. A girl said, "We need you in our social sorority. We need one more member. You'd be just the one." I said, "I'll join." Never got to do stuff like that in high school. I had to always go home straight from school. I never got to go to pep rallies. I never went to football games. So I joined this sorority and went through the initiation, and they had a dance at one of the girls' lake homes down the Warrior River, not too far out of Hueytown. And we got Mama Betty lined up for the children, and off to this dance we go. And never had a drink of alcohol in my mouth, much less in my hands. And we got down there, and they had a live band. They had an open bar. They had lights all around the yard, and the moon was reflecting over this water. Perfect. My husband walked up to me and handed me a drink. It was a Tom Collins. I'm an alcoholic who remembers her last drink. I won't tell you about my first one. It was in a real tall glass, and it had just a tint of pink to it. It had a straw. It had a toothpick across the top, and on that toothpick it had a maraschino cherry with a stem. It had a wedge of orange and a hunk of pineapple. Down at the bottom of this glass was a little umbrella. And when Bo said, "Here, honey, drink this," I drank it all, including the umbrella. And it just opened up inside me, and Shirley was never the same anymore. I liked it. I, for many years, thought alcohol was a stimulant. I really did, because it did for me, for an awfully long time, what I thought it was supposed to do. Now, I'm not an alcoholic who drank in bars. I never ran around. I've never been in jail. I've never had a DUI. I've done an awful lot of things. The damage I did in my kitchen on 28th Avenue in Hueytown and with my mouth. I tore my kids down every way you could tear them down with my mouth. I didn't have to do all those other things, but yet when I hit my bottom as hard as any girl who's ever been in this program who's done more than I think I've done. I just hadn't done it yet. You know, I would start drinking in the afternoons at 4:31, and whenever I passed out, it was time to go to bed. And let me tell you what I drank. All you guys who drink wine are winos. I'm a winette. Sounds just a little classier to me, but let me tell you what I drank. I drank the Boone's Farm Tickle Pink. Let me tell you why I drank that. It was $3.17, and I could take 3 $1 bills out of Mike's front blue jeans pocket for lunch money, put it with 17 cents, and buy a bottle. Or I could take a knife and slide that knife up Cece's piggy bank just enough for those quarters to slide out and put with 17 cents and go buy a bottle of wine. I would come home and I would pour that bottle of wine in a wine decanter and put it on the left side of the refrigerator. Mike and Cece loved strawberry Kool-Aid, and I kept it on the right side of the refrigerator in a white Tupperware pitcher. Mine was on the left, theirs was on the right. And I told them my Kool-Aid was there on the left, their Kool-Aid was on the right. And to this day, Cece won't touch Kool-Aid. Now, I don't know what she's going to do with these 2 kids. I don't. I don't know what she'll give them to drink unless it's iced tea. Because, she's afraid of Kool-Aid. She's absolutely terrified of Kool-Aid. And if I had to pick the one thing that's the smallest scar on this little girl of my alcoholism, it would have to be the Kool-Aid. There were many, 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 many others, but the tiniest had to be the Kool-Aid. I don't know when Mike's bedroom door started being locked. It used to drive me crazy, but it doesn't bother me today. But I would get up in the morning to go wake them up for school, and Mike's bedroom door was always locked, and I'd have to knock. That's sad when you can't even go into your little boy's bedroom. And then I'd go to Sissy's bedroom, and I'd walk in and go over to her bed and shake her, and her pillowcases were always wet. And I never once asked her why. I don't know whether maybe I just didn't want to know. But the one thing I knew was if she woke up one morning with a sore throat from having this wet hair that she didn't dry the night before, then I would have to call in at work, take her to the doctor, and I wouldn't get paid. Never once asked her why. When I went into treatment, this little girl sat across the room from me in treatment, and she said, "Mom, the reason my pillowcases were always wet was because I cried myself to sleep over you every night. I didn't know what else to do." And when I had been sober 2 years, Mike came up to me and he said, "Mom, the reason my bedroom door was always locked was because I cried myself to sleep over you every night, and I didn't think little boys were supposed to cry." You tell me this is not a family disease. You tell me that it's not a family disease. And my damage that I did was in my home under my roof, 24 hours a day. I'd cut Cece down like a knife. Cece's left-handed, and she would fold all the towels out of the dryer and put them in the linen closet while I was passed out. And I would get up sometime during the night and open up this linen closet and pull every one of those towels down because they weren't folded the way I wanted them folded. She put the dishes in the dishwasher, and she never put them in the way I wanted them because I'm right-handed. She's left-handed, and I told her one day, "If you can't load the dishwasher right, don't load it." I cut her down every way I could. I told her if she made better grades, I wouldn't drink. She made the honor roll. Can you imagine tearing those two kids down like I did? Bo came in one afternoon with a motorcycle in the back of his pickup truck, and I said, "Oh God, that's one more thing I've got to worry about." I thank God for that today, because Mike was able to get on that motorcycle and leave and get out of that crap at night. And his curfew was 10 o'clock, and he was always home, but Mom was always passed out. But Mike didn't get a lot of the crap Sissy did. My kids didn't have company over because they never knew what Mom was going to be like. I didn't let my kids go visit anybody because I didn't want Sissy and Mike to find out that we weren't living the great American dream anymore. I didn't know what was wrong with us, but I knew something wasn't right. I woke up one morning and I looked in the mirror and I saw this person that I just did not want to be. I had the natural glow about me that my daddy had on April the 30th, and I said, "You know, I'll never be like him." I looked in this mirror, and I didn't have those pretty brown eyes that my daddy gave me. They were just as bloodshot red as my daddy's were that night at the wedding. And I looked in this mirror, and I thought, "You know, God, I do not remember the last time Bo told me that he loved me. You know, God, I don't remember the last time Mike said, 'Mom, you smell so good.'" I said, "And you know, God, I don't know the last time Cece gave me a compliment." And this little voice came back to me and it said, "Shirley, when was the last time you told Bo you loved him? Hey, Shirley, when was the last time you told Mike he smelled good? Hey, Shirley, when was the last time you gave Cece a compliment?" You know, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to be an alcoholic. Everybody in Bessemer and Hueytown knew that Bo Templin's wife was a drunk. But don't call me an alcoholic. You know, in May of 82, my husband won an 8-day trip to Hawaii. And I can remember him coming home and saying, I don't know if we ought to go or not. I said, but we need to go. We need to start over. We're going to start over. We're going to go over there, and I'm not going to drink, and we're going to get this family put back together, and we're going to do some changes. And I remember getting on that airplane in Birmingham, and as soon as that plane got up in the air and they rolled that little cart by, I took a drink. And I'm here to tell you that for 8 days I stayed in the blackout. I do not remember the trip to Hawaii. I do not remember the picture I had made with Don Ho. I wish I'd brought it. Yeah, I don't know which one was the drunkest, me or Don Ho. We stayed 4 days at the Sheraton Waikiki, the most beautiful place on the Big Island. I don't remember it. We had 8 rolls of film, and I took the film. I took the pictures, and I don't remember it. And I can remember Bo saying, I'd give anything in the world if I'd given this trip to somebody else. Well, I got another shot at this, because in 2 months, my husband is speaking at an Al-Anon, an AA convention in Big Island of Hawaii. He's the Al-Anon luncheon speaker on Friday in October, and I'm going with him. And let me tell you where the convention's going to be. The Sheraton Waikiki. You tell me God doesn't take care of us drunks. He's given me another chance. And I'm going, and I'm going to get on that plane, and when that cart comes down that aisle, I'm either going to drink water, coffee, or nothing. But God's given me another chance, and I'm grateful for that. Well, my family went to ball games a lot, and they got to where they didn't like for me to go because, you see, I always embarrassed them. And they got ready to go to one ball game in July of 82, and Mike was 15 years old, and he was about a half of a head taller than me, and Sissy's 13 and a half. And as they started to walk out the door to go to this ball game, Mike turned around and he said, Mom, when we get home tonight, are you going to be passed out on the floor or passed out in bed? And for the first time in his life, I wanted to slap his teeth out. I wanted to yank him up by the collar and tell him, you're talking to your mother, and if you can't show just a little bit more respect than that, we'll see what we can do. He didn't wait for an answer. He did not wait for an answer. And out the door he went. And the only thing I could think to do was to go and get another drink. My son has just humiliated me. And the only way I knew to fix it was to take a drink. Let me tell you, a long time ago, the last time my daddy gave me a spanking was with the belt buckle into the belt. And while he was spanking me with that belt buckle, I said, if I ever have children, God, I promise you I will never lay a hand on them. And I never laid a hand on Mike or Sissy. That night when Mike said that to me, that was the closest that I've ever come to laying a hand on them. And I honestly believe if I had hit Mike, I might have killed him. I don't know what I would have done. Because I had been anesthetized for so long. I had drank for so long on a daily basis. I don't know what I would have done. Well, when they left, I took that glass of wine, and as I walked back to the front door to close it, the TV was off, but there was a telephone number across the screen. And it was to a treatment center, and with the wine glass in one hand and the telephone in the other, I dialed this number. Now, a treatment center will not get you sober. A treatment center is not for everybody. You know, I know that. In fact, my sponsor didn't go through a treatment center, and she just thinks that a treatment center is where you go have your meals fixed for you, and you lay around and get company on Sunday, and you get the Sunday pay. You know, it's just a vacation. And she didn't go through that. She, you know, she detoxed on honey and orange juice and the eggs and all that other stuff that, you know, you do. But she thinks that a treatment center is a vacation spot. And I went to this treatment center for 38 days. It was a 28-day program. I never have understood this, and I stayed 38 days. But anyway, I went to this treatment center, and my family took me up there and dropped me off and thought that when they came back and picked me up that I'd be okay and we'd live happily ever after. I wish it was that simple. I stayed the 38 days, and I wanted to stay 45, and they wouldn't let me. I can remember while I was in this treatment center, my mom wrote me a letter, and she said, I'd like to come and visit you, and I want to see where you are, because my mom had a hard time with her daughter being an alcoholic. My mom didn't understand alcoholism. She had lived with my daddy, but she just didn't think her little girl could be an alcoholic. So we arranged it for my mom to come and visit me. And by this time, my mom had married a man that just worshiped the ground that she walked on. And Pete was the daddy that I always dreamed of having, and he was the only daddy that I ever knew. But they came up and visited me on a Sunday, and I can remember my mom sitting there, and she said, will you be okay? And I said, Mom, yes, I'm going to be okay. You're not going to drink anymore, are you? And I said, well, I don't plan on drinking anymore. They tell me that I have to get involved in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I have to go to meetings for the rest of my life. And she said, you have to go to those meetings for the rest of your life? I said, yes, ma'am, I have to go to those meetings. And she said, well, okay. And, you know, she brought me this pot of mums. And when I left that treatment center, I planted those mums outside the cottage where I was. And I was back up there this past May. And guess what's still blooming at that cottage? Mums by the front door. I don't know whether they're mine or not, but there's mums blooming by the door of the ladies' cottage at Brookwood Mall, at Brookwood Lodge. Well, my mom came home, and I had lost my job in treatment, and I needed to make some memories. I needed to make some memories. One of the memories that I started making was with my children. This gal that sort of roped me and told me that she was going to be my sponsor, I looked at her and I said, I don't know how you could be my sponsor. You don't have any kids. And she said, that ain't got anything to do with it. And I said, well, what do we have in common? She said, well, I'm a drunk and you're a drunk. And you have a husband, I have a husband. And she said, well, I'm going to help you work the steps. And I said, okay. And she said, now, first of all, we need to start making these amends to your kids. And I said, they're not written in that order. She said, you've damaged your children greatly. And you need to make some amends to Mike and Sissy. We'll work on the other part of the steps, but you need to make some amends to these two kids. And I misunderstood, and I started doing a lot of the things for these kids that was wrong. When I went shopping, I would buy them something. I would buy Mike a tape or Sissy a blouse or Sissy a pair of jeans or something, and I'd bring them home, and they loved it. I was real good to stick a $5 or a $10 bill. Now, you must understand this is many, many years ago, in an envelope under their pillow, and they loved it. By this time, Mike and Sissy had been introduced to Alateen, and they came to me one night and said, Mom, we love all these things that you're doing for us, but if this is payback, we don't want them. Now, if you want to buy us something because you just want to buy it, that's fine, but there's no payback on any of the crap that we all went through when you were drinking. How about that? I've been sober 15 months when my mom called. She said, I have the very same thing that your grandmother had when she died at the age of 50. And I got mad at God. Because I said, I'm sober now, God. Don't take my mother. Don't take my mother. And I can remember my mom saying, I've got to go on the kidney dialysis twice a week. And I said, well, Mom, I can't take a drink one day at a time. You go on that machine, and I'll not drink one day at a time. My mom was on the kidney dialysis machine for 3.5 years, 2 days a week. And this old girl was there every time she hooked up to that machine. If Bo and I were going to a convention on Friday, we went after she came off of the machine on Friday night. If anyone called and asked me to speak on Friday night anywhere, I would say, if you can put me anywhere else, I have a prior commitment on Friday night. One night while I was at this machine with my mom, she looked at me and she said, Shirley, of my 3 kids, honey, you've turned out to be the best. Mike and Sissy couldn't have a better mother if they searched the whole world over. And you've been the only one of my children that's been here with me every single time that I've hooked up to this machine, and I love you. My mom made an amends to me because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank you for that. When I was a couple of months away from 5 years in this program, my mom said to me, can I give you your 5-year chip? I said, you bet you can. And she said, well, you work it out with your club, your group. I said, it's worked out. And I said, we'll have the cake and you can give me my chip. And we planned on that for just a couple of months. And 1 month before my 5-year chip in Alcoholics Anonymous, my best girlfriend died. And she didn't get to give me my chip. Cece stood up there and she said, I'm filling in for my grandmother tonight who had a date with God. My grandmother wanted to give my mom her chip, but you know how God is. He has his own timetable. And Cece gave me my chip. At the back of the room was this little fella, this little blonde-headed fella named Mike. And he came up to me and he said, Mom, if anything should ever happen to you, they would have to bury me with you because I love you so much. And I said, Mike, you don't know what you would do until you've been in those shoes. No, I would. I know I would. This year that I got sober, this July of 82 that I got sober, Mike flunked that year in school. So he had to repeat that year over. He never had a problem with that. He never had a problem with that. I had the problem with that. I could not look at him in the face, in the eyes, because I was so ashamed that I had taken away 1 year of his life. 1 year of his life. And when it got time for the end of the year, when graduation was coming up and the prom was coming up, he came home one day from school and he said, well, they're having the prom and I just don't think I'll go. He said, I've sat down and figured out that by the time you get the flowers and you have the dinner and you rent the tux and you go pick her up and you take her back home and have the pictures made and all that is, I said, well, Mike, I'll pay for everything. He said, I'll go. So we got him ready. He rented the tux and we made all the arrangements for the flowers and all this kind of stuff. And on Monday night before the prom, on Friday night, the phone rang at the house. And I answered the phone and it was this friend of ours named Jim. And he said, let me talk to Mike. And I said, why do you want to talk to Mike? He said, it's none of your business. Let me talk to Mike. So Mike got on the phone and he stood there and he was just beaming from ear to ear. And yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then about that time, a tear came out of his eye. And a tear came out of his eye. And he said, oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir, I'll be there. Thank you so much. Yes, sir. And he hung up. I said, what was that all about? And he said, well, that's yours and Dad's friend that has the dealership up in Bessemer. And he said, if I'd come by there Friday afternoon after I got out of school, I could pick out any car I wanted on the car lot to drive to the prom. And he said, Mom, I wouldn't have that if you weren't drinking, if you were drinking. And he said, thank you for being sober. Well, he went on to the prom and had a great time, had a ball, took care of that car, and then the next month he graduated. And we had him a little party there at the house, and my mom was there. This was right before she died. My mom was there, and my stepdad was there. And we had this party, and Mike got a little nervous. He got a little nervous, so he called me in his bedroom, and he was leaving for Florida right after graduation for a week. And I figured he was going to hit me up for a loan, and that was okay with me. So I went in his bedroom, and he said, I need to tell you just a couple of things, three things to be exact. And I said, okay. He said, sit down on my bed. I said, it must be important. He said, it is, and I'm closing the door. So he said, number one, Mom, I'd like to thank you for being sober. Have you ever been thanked by one of your kids for being sober? He said, Cece tells you that all the time. But I think about it all the time, but I never tell you. So I wanted to tell you how proud I am that you're sober. And he said, number two, Mom, for a long time there's been a glass wall up between us because you blame yourself for this year I flunked in school. And I said, yeah, Mike, I do. I said, if you had had a home to stay in and study and not have to get on that motorcycle and leave at night, maybe you wouldn't have flunked that year. He said, Mom, let me tell you something. I flunked myself. You didn't flunk me. Cece made the honor roll. And he said, I used your drinking as an excuse. And Mom, in just a few minutes, I'm going to get my diploma from high school, and I'm going to pass by you, and I'm going to give you thumbs up. And he said, as far as I'm concerned, there's never, ever to be another word said or mentioned about this year that I flunked. Is that clear? And you know, I thought of the promises of the big book. And I thought about going through those steps and thinking, they'll never happen to me. Because for so long in this program, I thought of myself as junk. I had a really tough time with thinking that I had another chance. And I started to get up. He said, wait a minute. I said three things. And I said, well, I don't know what in the world you're going to come up with number three. But there's no way it can be better than number one and number two. And he said, it is. He said, number three, Mom, no matter how many little girls I date, you will always be my number one girl. And I thought of the promises again, and I thought, what do I do? And I stood up, and I walked over to him, and I put my arms around him, and he put his arms around me, and let me tell you what went down, the glass wall. And it never came back up again, and it was never mentioned again. Was never mentioned again. As we went back into the living room to get ready to go to this graduation, I looked out the front door and there were five cans of beer sitting on the front step. And I called Mike over. I said, all right, what's this? He said, it's five cans of beer. I said, I know, but where did they come from? And he said, well, Mom, a bunch of my friends drink. And he said, I invited them all to the party. But I told them that we did not allow alcohol in our home anymore, and they would have to leave it outside. They'll pick it up when they go back out. No big deal. He said, now there's one of them that I told if he didn't behave, you'd take his car keys. I said, no, you didn't tell him that, did you? He said, yeah, I told him. So we went on to the graduation, and the five cans of beer were picked up, and Mike graduated, and the next year when Cece graduated, heck, she didn't call me into her bedroom. I was kind of disappointed. But she had gotten an Alateen, see, and we had our little talk, our mother-daughter talk, when I had been sober 7 months, when she came in from school one day, and she said, Mom, my sponsor said that if I ever got better in this program, I had to get rid of the garbage. And she said, I've written down on paper everything you said to me when you were drunk or in a blackout. And I must read those things to you if I'm going to get better. And I said, okay. So we went in her bedroom and we closed the door and locked it. And we got up in the middle of her big canopy bed and we sat there Indian-legged facing each other. And for 2 hours, she read to me everything I had ever called her, everything I'd ever said to her, everything I'd ever torn down, the linen in the linen closet, the dishwasher I never did right. And when she got through, she said, well, that's it. That's all of it. And I said, Sissy, I don't know what to say, except I'm sorry. And she said, that's all you have to say. It'll never be brought up again. It's never been brought up again. Tell me what a strong program that little girl has. Well, she went off to college, and she was finishing up her first year, and Mike came to me and his dad, and he said, I'd like to move Sissy home for you. I said, oh, that's too much. Don't worry about that. Your dad and I'll get her home. No, Mother, I have a couple of buddies with pickup trucks. Please let us go down and move her back home. It was just 40 miles one way. And so I looked at Bo, and I said, what do you think? He said, well, we'll feed them, you know, when we get through. And so they moved Sissy home the weekend of Mother's Day of 1988. And when they brought everything home, they put it in the living room and left it. And I said, don't you think we better move this out of the living room? Mike said, she's moving back out in 2 months. Leave it, you know. The easier, softer way. So we left it right there in the living room. And while these kids were all eating, I said, I really do appreciate this, that it really saved me and your dad a lot of trouble. Mike says, hey, Mom, we were just going down there and checking out all the girls on our dorm floor. He said, you know that big book that you read, that big book that you have, you've got highlighted this sentence, be willing to go to any length to get it. Hey, he worked his program too, you know. Well, I went to a meeting on Tuesday night, May the 17th, at my Bessemer group, and Mike had a date, Sissy had a date, and Bo was at work. And at 9:05 that night, our whole world changed, because at 9:05 that night, Mike was killed instantly by a drunk driver. And everything I had ever done in this program, all these amends that I had made to these kids, that this lady made sure that I did on time, everything I'd ever heard in meetings, everything I'd ever shared with somebody else just went right out the window. And the only thing I could think of was, why me, God? Why me? What part of this program did I not do right? God, you show me now. You took my mother 11 months ago. 11 months ago. And now you've taken my little boy. I'm sober. And I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. God, you tell me what it is I'm doing wrong. I don't remember those 72 hours. I know that the girls at Bessemer came over in shifts of 3 hours and babysat me. They made sure I went to the bathroom. They made sure I had a little Dixie cup of milk if it would go down. They made sure I laid down whether my eyes would close or not. Mike had just bought a brand new motorcycle, brand new. It was not 1 month old. He was not on it. He was in a car. And in my pajamas, I would go out and I'd sit on that motorcycle on the patio and put that helmet on my head. And I'd turn around and Marion would be there behind me. And I'd say, Marion, what am I going to do? And she'd say, I don't know, but I'll do it with you. I couldn't take a shower by myself. There was always a little girl in there with me because they just didn't think I could do it. At the cemetery, Sissy came up to me and she said, I used to lay awake, Mom, when you were drinking, and I'd say, God, please let her die. Just take her in her sleep. Just take her in her sleep and let her die. And she said, then you'd take that money out of my piggy bank and you'd steal that money out of my piggy bank and you'd go buy a bottle of wine. And I'd say, God, let her forget where she lives. And she took my head, my face in her hands, and she said, lady, let me tell you something. You will make it. Do you hear me? Hey, lady, do you hear me? You will make it. My dad and I'll make sure that you get to meetings and that we all get through this together. There was this one girl at this time that I was trying to help, and she just couldn't stay sober. She just could not stay sober. And her husband had left her at the house and had the power left on and the telephone, but she didn't have a car, and he would bring her groceries on Fridays. And I took her home from this meeting on Tuesday night that Mike died. I never will forget her. And I told her, I said, now I'll see you at the meeting tomorrow night. And she said, I'll walk. That's what she wanted to do, was walk. I took her home that Tuesday night, and Thursday night at that funeral home, I looked up, and there she was in that line. She looked at me, and she said, is this what God's going to do to me if I get sober? And I said, that's a question below the belt. That's not fair. God did not do this to me. You must believe that God did not do this to me. I have never seen that girl again. I went by our house, and everything was gone. The gate was closed. The house was empty. The phone disconnected. I don't know where she is, but God, I hope I didn't run her off because of what happened to me. You know, Pete, my stepdad, the dad that I always knew was my real dad, stood outside the funeral home and shook 617 people's hands as they walked in and said, I'm Mike's granddaddy. I'm Mike's granddaddy. I called my real dad the night this happened, and I said, Dad, Mike's been killed by a drunk driver. He said, well, he never showed up. He never showed up. I don't think he ever is. Well, Mike was buried on this Friday, and my husband has an outpatient treatment center. And we had invitations in the mail for 6 weeks for this open house, for this outpatient treatment center that saves a lot of lives. And Mike was buried that day of the open house. The dignitaries had already been invited, the food ordered, the invitations in the mail. They tell me I was there that afternoon, but I don't believe it. But I told Bo, I said, this treatment center will always be here to save lives because of Mike. Mike's a part of this treatment center. It really is. Saturday morning, we went up to the hospital to see this little girl, and I leaned over to kiss her, and she said, can I tell you something? I said, sure you can. And she said, it should have been me that died in this wreck instead of Mike. And I said, why do you say that? And she said, well, my mom and dad are divorced, and neither one of them care about me. She said, I live with my daddy in the summer. I live with my mom during the school year to go to school. And she said, they're always fighting over me. And she said, you both love Mike, and he knew it. And it just should have been me that died in this wreck. And I said, I don't want to hear that anymore. And that little girl, well, I'll see her, or she'll call and wish me a happy Mother's Day. How about that? Not too long ago, a friend of mine called and said, would I come to Cullman, Alabama, which is 60 miles from Bessemer, and very spur of the moment, he had to go out of town on an emergency and asked me if I'd come and share, and I said, why, sure. And I hung up the phone, and the minute I hung up the phone, my program went out the window. Because, you see, I had dinner in the oven that was not ready. I had clothes in the washer that were not through. The dryer had clothes in it that needed to be taken out, and I lost it. And I said, why did I say I'd go? Bo says, well, that's because you're supposed to be there. For some reason, you're supposed to be there. And I griped and I complained 60 miles to Cullman. And two times my husband pulled the van over the side of the road and he said, now, are we going to go back home? Are we going to Cullman? And I said, well, I guess it's meant for me to be in Cullman. Let's go. I wasn't a real happy camper. And we get up there, and Cullman is an old group above the pool hall on Main Street. You have to go up a flight of steps, and they have the light bulbs that hang from the ceiling that are naked, and their couches on the side of the wall with the springs that come up. That's for the newcomers. Good group, real good group in Cullman. And I got there in time to get a cup of coffee and come up front. And just as I get to the part about Mike dying, this little boy on the front row put his head down in his lap, and he cried like a baby. I looked at Bo, and I thought, God, what do I do? This has never happened to me. I've lost it up here before, but I've never seen a little boy put his head in his lap and cry. And I thought, well, I'll go on. So I did. And just as we got through the Lord's Prayer, this little fella came up and he hugged me so hard, I thought I was going to lose my breath. He said, oh, Miss Templin, I'm so glad to see you. And I said, do you know me? He said, oh, yes, ma'am, I know you. And I said, how do I know you? And he said, I graduated from high school with Mike. I said, no, you didn't. He said, well, I did. I was at Mike's graduation party. And I said, well, son, I'm sorry, but I just don't recognize you. He said, well, let me see. Do you remember those 5 cans of beer that were sitting on the front step? I said, yes, I sure do. One of those cans of beer was mine. And do you remember Mike telling you that there was a guy there that might get his keys taken away from him if he didn't behave? That was me. I said, no. He said, 2 weeks after graduation, I ran into Mike in downtown Bessemer, and he put his arm on my shoulder and he said, James, here's my mom's telephone number. And if you ever want help with your drinking problem, you call my mom. She'll help you. And I said, you never have called, have you? He said, no, ma'am, I haven't. I said, what are you doing up here in Cullman? He said, well, my family's kicked me out. I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 27. I said, that's how old Mike would be. He said, I'm up here in a halfway house. And he said, first of all, I want to apologize for the way I look. He said, they wouldn't let me have company today. So I said, what the heck? I won't take a shower. I won't shave. I won't go down to dinner. I'll show them. And he said, I was laying up in my room with a newspaper. And he said, there's a rule at that treatment center, that halfway house, that the van will not leave unless all the seats are full. He said, the horn tooted, and I said, I ain't going. He said, the horn tooted again, and he said, by God, I ain't going. He said, by the time the horn tooted the third time, I had my shoes on. I ran my fingers through my hair, and I went out and got in the van. And he said, when I walked up the steps of this club, I saw you, and I said, it must be meant for me to be here. I told him if he got back to Hueytown, if he'd call me, I'd take him to a meeting. But let me tell you what I did on the way home. I thanked God. for not letting Bo turn that van around. Because you see, I'd have missed it. I'd have missed it. God's put things like that in my life every time I needed it since Mike died. Some days I do okay. You know, I still have gotten, I'm getting better on this, but I'll go shopping and I'll see a royal blue or a Kelly green or some bright shirt that I think would look good on him, and I buy it. And Bo said, that's okay. And I give it to a kid who needs it. Bo had this emergency surgery this summer, and we were on this airplane coming back from Houston, and he looked at me and he said, I don't want to scare you, hon, but I think I'm having a heart attack. And I said, oh, no, you're not either. Not on this airplane, you're not. And that's not what I said, but I'd rather not say what I said. And so we get him home, and he goes into the hospital. And when I get home for a little while for a break, I call Pete. I try to call Pete to tell him, because he stays in real good touch with me, and he comes out and spends a weekend or two with us every once in a while. And Pete's my buddy. Pete's a man I think an awful lot of. And I couldn't find him. No one answered at his house, and he doesn't have an answer machine. And so I went back to the hospital, and I told Bo, I said, there's something wrong. Pete doesn't answer. And I called my brother. He wasn't there. And found out that Pete had had a stroke, and he was on the other side of Birmingham in another hospital, paralyzed on his left side. And my brother didn't want to tell me, because I was in Bessemer with Bo in the hospital. And once again, I said, God, please don't let anything happen to Pete. You know, I have to have this man. He's the one that when I came home from treatment, I asked him what he wanted for Father's Day. He said, Shirley, what I really want more than anything is I want a big book. And I said, a big book? He said, when your mom got sick, I read everything written on her type of cancer. I knew what to expect. I knew how long she would live. I knew everything there was to know. And he said, if you tell me you have a disease called alcoholism, I want to learn everything there is to learn about it. And I think I can learn that out of the big book. So Bo and I bought him a big book, and we put an inscription in it to Pete. And he would call the house at night, and he would say, I'm on page so-and-so, and I need to talk to Bo. And I said, Pete, I'm the alcoholic. And he said, yeah, but I need to talk to Bo. Well, he came out to our house in March of this year, and we knew he really wasn't in good health. He was getting on up in age. And one of the things we talked about was, if anything ever happened to him, he wanted me to have his big book back that I had given him for Father's Day. Well, July the 3rd at 5:25, Pete died. And I thought, I'm not going to make it. You know, what am I going to do? Pete was the one that would call me and he'd say, you lost your mom and you lost Mike in a year. Shirley, how do you do it and not drink? And I said, well, I go to a lot of meetings, Pete. My brother was worried. He would call and he'd say, are you going to be okay, or do you need to come up here and stay? And I'd say, no, I'm going to be okay. But Pete was a fine man. He loved me. And he's the only daddy I ever knew. The only daddy I ever knew. Right after Mike died, I did everything but drink. I didn't eat, I didn't bathe, I didn't sleep. I didn't answer the telephone, I didn't go to the door, I didn't go to meetings unless I was forced to go to meetings. And so one morning he called my sponsor and he said, I'm bringing her over. I don't know what you're going to do with her, but I'm bringing her over. And we went over there, and he let me out of the van, and Katie said, how about a drink, Shirley? And I said, I don't think I want a drink. And she said, well, come on in. I have the coffee pot ready, and I have the big book, and I have a legal pad. And I said, Katie, I don't anymore to do with a legal pad. I've had all the legal pad deal that, you know, because that scares me when I see a legal pad. And she said, well, this is going to be real simple. I'm just going to ask you 3 questions, and then you can go home. And on this legal pad, she had 2 lines drawn down it. And on one side, she put things I'm grateful for. And on the other side, she put things I'm not grateful for. And she said, I'm going to ask you 3 questions, and then you can go home. I said, okay. And she said, question number one, the night Mike died, was Mike drinking? And I said, no, ma'am, he was not. And she said, put that in the right column that you think it needs to go in. She said, question number two, Shirley, the night Mike died, was he using drugs? I said, no, ma'am, he was not using drugs. And she said, put that under the column that you think it needs to go under. She said, now, before I ask you this third one, you better think about it very carefully, because you've got to live with this for the rest of your life. But she said, Shirley, the night Mike was killed by that drunk driver, was his mother drinking or using drugs? And I said, no, ma'am, I was not. And she said, Shirley, you're going to be okay. You won't ever be fine again, but you're going to be okay. You're going to have to allow the people in this program to pick you up and carry you, and I guarantee you there will be times when you won't want to be carried. And I looked at her and I said, Katie, how in the world could you possibly know how I feel? I said, you never had kids. You don't know the pain that I feel for losing a child. And she said, let me tell you something about pain. God never blessed me with any children. God never let me have any children. Don't you sit there. Don't you sit there and tell me that I don't know about pain when he gave you one of each. And you had Mike for 20 and a half years. God, if you don't do anything else, you've got 20 and a half years of memories. And she said, you had things with Mike that a lot of people never have in 80 years. And what you've got to do is find you some gratitude. And that lady is real special to me. Every time I see her, I tell her that I'm sorry for what I said to her, because I didn't understand it. She understood my pain. God's put 4 hunks in my life. My first hunk is my husband, my best friend, my driver, the father of my children, a good granddaddy. The second hunk is that little boy named Mike who lives up in heaven. I tell you what, he would have been just as fine a daddy and just as fine a husband as his own dad, because he was a chip off the old block. The third one is this fellow named Bob that's vowed to love my little girl, and he does. It's amazing to me. You can watch him when she walks into the room. His eyes just follow her. You know, he just loves her to death. And I honestly believe they have a good marriage based on the 12 steps of this program. And if you work the steps in your marriage like I do for my alcoholism, and you mesh these programs together, it can't do anything but get better. The fourth hunk is this young man who recorded a song named Ronnie Millsap. And if you have one verse of this song, it will sum up Shirley Templin. And I'm going to close with one verse of that song. What a difference you made in my life. What a difference you made in my life. You're my sunshine day and night. Oh, what a difference you made in my life. And that's my AA. Thank you, and I love you.